Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, ladies and gents, to episode 86 of the Absolute Return Podcast. I'm Julian Klimochko.
And I'm Mike Kessler.
Today is Friday, September 11th, 2020, back in the swing of things. Children back in school, markets picking up again, some volatility this week. Markets actually went down this week, which we haven't seen in quite the while after the post-COVID bull market that we've had, really, with this massive growth stock bubble. Nonetheless, a few interesting items that we wanted to discuss on the podcast this week. Off the top, Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, greatest investor of all time, they subscribed to an IPO of loss-making cloud data company Snowflake. Has Berkshire finally given up on value investing? LVMH launches a risky gambit in a bid to reprice their Tiffany deal. Will this unprecedented move in M&A actually work? Lastly, we're going to chat about Tesla's stock crashing as it's snubbed by the S&P 500 Index Committee to join the benchmark. What happened here? Why wasn't Tesla added? But Mike, I want to start off with this news that was unveiled in the S1 of Snowflake. Now, Snowflake is about to go public. I believe they're going to start trading on Wednesday. They filed for a $2.38 billion IPO, which will make it one of the largest stock market debuts of the year. Values the company over $20 billion, double its previous valuation. And in that S1 filing, which is the prospectus that they got to file prior to going public, which unveils what the company does, financials, etc., indicated that Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, long a bastion of value investing, you know, he's long preached it, been the most practiced and most celebrated value investor of all time. Have they finally thrown in the towel on value investing? Because it's basically sucked for so long. I mean, they disclosed a $250 million share subscription in Snowflake's IPO. So Berkshire Hathaway investing in a cloud data company is one thing that's mind-blowing, but subscribing to an IPO, like, it makes it double mind-blowing, because Berkshire Hathaway has, you know, up until recently, never bought a new issue. I got a quote here from Buffett from a CNBC interview last year. He stated, quote, "In 54 years, I don't think Berkshire's ever bought a new issue." So that's quite the track record of snubbing the IPO market, as many skeptics agree. IPO could stand for it's probably overpriced or idiots purchase only. But I digress. Some info on Snowflake. It's been around for about 8 years. It's a data warehouse built for the cloud, counts major enterprise software providers such as Google, Amazon, and Microsoft as partners. And if we look at what Berkshire has done and currently does, you know, they've done it over the past 50 years, was to invest in highly profitable companies at low valuations, like when they had that big investment into Apple a handful of years ago at a very low valuation, back when Apple traded at a single-digit earnings multiple. Typically, Buffett's benchmark is a 10% earnings yield. So he likes to buy things at single-digit earnings multiples, which is why Snowflake is so surprising, because if you look at Snowflake's financials, they lost nearly $350 million red ink last year. The valuation is just absolutely sky high, more than 78 times revenue last fiscal year. So forget about earnings. I mean, this company has seemingly spiraling losses, increasing dramatically. However, the revenue top line is growing significantly, and the valuation is extremely lofty, certainly reflects that growth, but it really lends credence to what we've seen as a pretty big change in Berkshire Hathaway over the last decade. As we know, Buffett has brought on his lieutenants Todd Combs and Ted Weschler, and they have quite a bit of different style than Buffett has, don't they?
Yeah, they certainly do. And when you mention, you know, I guess just the recent past, where in the last few weeks you had likely Buffett investment into the six Japanese trading firms at a discount to NAV.
Classic value investing.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And that one was confirmed to be Buffett, because when Berkshire is buying, typically the ones over $1 billion are Buffett buys. However, the ones under $1 billion are either Todd or Ted, so
and,
not Buffett.
And why that's assumed is because Todd and Ted each, I believe they still have just $10 billion to manage. I say just because in the context of Berkshire as a whole, Berkshire has a $200 billion equities book.
Yeah, and so the stake in Apple is what, like 80, 90 billion?
Yeah, it's 45% of their book.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, looking at, has Berkshire changed as a whole? No, because you have Buffett with the Japanese trading firm's investment. You have the smaller investments in Barrick Gold and Snowflake, both of those under $1 billion.
Yeah, and many were like scratching their heads on Barrick. They're like, you know, what's Berkshire doing? These Warren Buffett's talk trash about gold, but if you look historically, there's a point in time where he had a massive position in silver. He was like the biggest investor in silver. So, you know, despite what he says, you got to look at actually what he does. And the Barrick investment was either Todd or Ted. So Buffett had nothing to do with that one.
Exactly. Regardless. And those are small investments anyway. They account to under 50 basis points in terms of a percentage of their whole equity book. So they're very immaterial in the context of Berkshire as a whole. But as well, you look at, there was some sales that he made in Wells Fargo and Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
Those were especially, well, Wells Fargo was a long-term investment, but there's been a lot of drama within Wells Fargo. Management called a question. Goldman Sachs especially, though, that was more of a strategic investment that he made in the crisis that really it's taken him 12 years to get out of. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of those investments, he still loves financials. Financials is 26% of his $200 billion equity book.
He was recently adding to B of A, though. Right?
Yeah, which is his second largest position in their entire book. So this is obvious with Snowflake. This is a Todd move, to be likely a Todd move.
Certainly, because his signature is in the S-1 filing, so that basically confirms that Todd made the call to invest Berkshire's capital into Snowflake's IPO.
Exactly. And so Snowflake, so what does Snowflake do? They focus on cloud data warehousing space. And you had mentioned some of their partners. Now, why they have Amazon, Google, and Microsoft as partners is because they work, their architecture or their databases work on top of AWS, Google Cloud, and Microsoft Azure. So they're users of those products. And why clients love, their enterprise clients love it as a service is because some other actual providers of this will lock you into a particular vendor. They'll only work with AWS. So mm-hmm. Snowflake is very agile and they will let you work with different vendors, but they were founded by former Oracle employees. Kind of interesting to note that neither of their founders ever served as CEO. They've actually had three CEOs throughout their time as a company. They've raised a ton of capital, as you had mentioned, Julian, over $1.4 billion. Right now, in terms of the space that they're in data warehousing, they are third in market share, where with 10%, with SAP being the biggest player in the space at 15%. So it's still a fairly fragmented market that could be ripe for consolidation in the future. But the business itself, it relies on these enterprise clients, where it is a massive payment when you do get one of these contracts. And for example, right now, one of their biggest clients is Capital One, which represents 11% of their revenue. But they do have, I believe it's a couple thousand clients in total. So they do have a number of smaller clients, not just big key clients like this. But what's very interesting, what I found interesting at least, is that they're currently spending 70% of their revenue on sales and marketing, which is high even for the enterprise software industry, which typically does spend quite high on their potential clients. As we discussed with Palantir a few weeks ago, they spend a ton as well, because these government, in Palantir's case, government contracts, they're long-term and sticky. But in this situation, Snowflake has only been around 8 years, so it still does remain a little bit uncertain, to me at least, whether it is worth all of this investment into potential clients, 70% of revenue. You'd typically see at the high end of enterprise software where 50% would be considered high. So that is quite high for the industry. It remains to be seen like how sticky these relationships can be over the long term. But ultimately, it was interesting that Berkshire got involved in this deal. Mm-hmm. However, it's really not material to Berkshire as a whole. So I guess people can read through, if you do, like myself, believe that there is a reasonable chance that Todd Combs takes on a massive role upon Buffett and Munger leaving, their departure, or I guess death, I think Todd Combs does have a legitimate shot at taking over Berkshire. Then I guess there is a read through in terms of how the investments will be done moving forward.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, if we look at Warren Buffett, has a strategy changed now? Still a diehard value investor, Mike, as you indicated. He's been out buying these Japanese trading houses, trading at single digit earnings multiple. His lieutenant Todd Combs is the one participating in these kind of growth stories through the Snowflake IPO. Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger have long avoided IPOs and warned investors against participating in them, but clearly Todd and Ted have different investment styles with the Snowflake investment, the Barrick Gold investment, etc. As for Snowflake, it plans to start trading in New York on Wednesday under the ticker symbol SNOW. I mean, that's a good one. On to some M&A news. After months of speculation, and if you look at Tiffany's stock, clearly the market was expecting something potentially. Read a lot of sell side notes, and a lot of analysts were expecting LVMH to make a move. The spread was quite distressed. The deal price is at 135 and it was trading sub 120. So a spread so wide you could drive a truck through, but certainly justified, because after months of speculation in the media and by traders and arbitragers that LVMH was having second thoughts on the price of its Tiffany acquisition, because it was initially struck in November pre-COVID, when multiples specifically for a luxury retailer would be significantly much, much higher than they would be these days. LVMH this week unveiled a risky gambit in order to try to extract a price concession from Tiffany's board of directors. Thus far, they haven't been having any discussions with respect to a price cut. Tiffany's board takes the attitude, look, a deal is a deal. At 135, that's where we struck it. That's where you got to close it. And certainly in today's environment, yes, LVMH is overpaying. But LVMH's CEO, Bernard Arnault, he's actually one of the richest men in the world. Richest guy in Europe, net worth of nearly $90 billion.
Second in the world, is it?
Yeah, something, they're always changing. But the Tiffany deal is about $16 billion, and LVMH is an order of magnitude larger, so somewhat a drop in the bucket. But what he pulled this week shocked everyone out there. So what he did was he contacted the French government. He got turned away by the first minister that he spoke to, and then got the second government group within the French government to agree to send out a letter indicating that due to the potential tariffs between France and the US, which France is going to implement some sort of digital tax. And so the Trump administration wanted to get back at them by taxing French luxury goods or something of that nature. Due to that trade war, for some reason, the French government would compel LVMH not to close the acquisition of Tiffany, and LVMH came with that letter in hand that the CEO, Bernard Arnault, basically told the French government to write. They took that to Tiffany and be like, whoops, sorry, the government won't let us close this deal. But it was quickly revealed in the media, like within hours of this news story breaking, that the letter did come direct from, basically an order from LVMH's CEO. In addition, the French government indicated that it was a non-binding order. It was more of a suggestion that was obviously written by the LVMH.
Wait, it was that they advised them, which is a key word.
Yeah, exactly. So relations between the companies obviously hit a bit of a snag here. Tiffany, they filed a lawsuit to compel LVMH to close. They allege that LVMH has been dragging its feet on filing for the requisite antitrust approvals. One specifically is the European Commission, which we expected a long time ago. Tiffany indicated that the deal should have closed in July had LVMH filed the requisite antitrust filings in time. LVMH coming back saying that they're about to make this EC filing any day now. You know, we check on it all the time. Still not there. So this deal is heading to court, some animosity between the parties. But what do I think is going to happen? Like, it's clear that LVMH has been consistently looking for a price cut over the past number of months. We did talk about this a few months back when that Women's Wear Daily article came out with respect to the LVMH's board having discussions on what legal strategy, what legal recourse they have to try to get this price cut. We've discussed in the podcast historically where these precedents have been, typically in the 5 to 12% range. We have seen some price cuts over this deal cycle, especially throughout COVID. We saw it on the trash deal, Advanced Waste. That one was repriced, I believe, down 12%. We saw it on an auto parts deal, BorgWarner's acquisition of Delphi Technologies. That one was repriced downwards 5%. We do have two other big deals in court right now, which is Simon's acquisition of Taubman. Got a position in that. Gotta disclose, we actually have a position in Tiffany in the Accelerate Arbitrage Fund in addition to Taubman. And a third deal that's currently in court that we're long is the Gilat Satellite deal acquisition by Comtech. And, you know, clearly the target's businesses have declined, at least temporarily, as we go through the COVID-induced recession. And the buyer's having a bit of buyer's remorse, which is, I'm most surprised by LVMH, given that typically a buyer wants to get out of a deal when they, say, lose financing, or they can't afford it, or they don't have the capital, or perhaps they're just like a short-term player like a private equity firm. But LVMH, Tiffany, this deal was highly strategic. LVMH has basically rolled up the whole industry, and this is pretty much the last big target left. They obviously have the cash, and they do have a long-term framework, but clearly CEO Bernard Arnault is, you know, he wants to get it cheaper. Those are my thoughts on this deal. And he's basically doing whatever he can to try to extract a price cut. This one might be tough here because, man, I've never seen a gambit go so bad so quickly. As I said, within hours, it was unveiled by Reuters that this was just a scheme pulled off by LVMH to engage in a bit of crony capitalism, which is disappointing, especially in an environment like France where they have the Yellow Jacket protests and they're highly against the whole crony capitalism and the wealthiest man in Europe and one of the richest in the world gaining favor from his government friends to save himself perhaps $500 million or so. So it could serve as something that will fly back in his face. We'll obviously closely monitor this one. The market, obviously, the stock was going to trade down, but not down a ton. It's still trading, what, around 114, 115. And analysts think that the unaffected share price, say, if this deal were to break, would be around the $80 range. So ARBs obviously think that there's a high success chance on this deal, at least with a recut. Tiffany stock was down about 6.9% this week on the news. So the market not pricing in a deal break here, however, pricing in a decent chance of a price cut. What are your thoughts on this really extreme situation?
Much of the Risk ARB desk commentary that we've seen over the last little bit has really been, as you had mentioned, Julian, everybody was expecting this eventually, given the messaging from LVMH. And when I say expecting this, expecting that it would go to court. They weren't expecting how. So a lot of the commentary was that a lot of Risk ARBs were staying out of the deal until a deal break was announced.
Or
and then
deal turbulence.
Yes, any sort of turbulence, and then to enter the trade. And so that provided a bit of a floor, and why it bounced off, I believe it bottomed out at around the $108 mark before rebounding a bit, where you probably did have some ARBs coming back into the name. But overall, I mean, this was, I'll give Arnaud credit. This was a very creative way that he did this.
Extremely creative.
Where everybody was expecting that they would invoke an MAE clause.
Yeah. Which they did, actually.
Yes. And that part was expected. This other part was completely out of left field. And what this will really come down to, and the basis of their argument, which has likely already been unveiled to be not true, is whether this was an order from the French government or it was the French government advising them not to close the deal. Because those are two very different things and a very different legal distinction. Order, their hands literally are tied.
Yeah, and I've heard commentary from lawyers that indicated only the European Commission could block this deal. And then on the issue with the French government, I saw an article in the New York Post today indicating that Tiffany would compel Arnaud to testify on this letter from the French government and whether or not he directed it. And there's speculation that he would actually just rather close a deal on the terms than having to go through that.
Absolutely. And I believe it was their CFO that was making comments and taking questions from the press when asked if LVMH had reached out to the government. This was before this was all unveiled, literally right before. There was a question on whether LVMH had reached out to the government proactively. And his response was akin to, I can't believe you would ask such a question. And
how
that is,
that,
yeah, being very distraught with them even asking the question, which was quite a bit of PR savvy from a CFO. I am quite impressed where he didn't say explicitly either way. So he just expressed disgust at the question and moved on, which is quite savvy of him, I guess, when you're in a situation that you can't really say that you didn't reach out to them because you did. Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting situation. But Julian, what do you think in terms of probability tree? I know what the street was kind of thinking now is that there's probably about a 20% chance of the deal closing on terms, 30% chance, or sorry, it was 30% chance of the deal closing on terms, 20% of it being completely terminated, and then about a 50% chance of a recut. Do you think those probabilities are somewhat accurate, or how would you handicap it?
Yeah, I think the probabilities are accurate in terms of the magnitude of the price cut. That is where the debate is. So just to summarize what happened here, LVMH came with its letter saying, oh, we can't close. Tiffany sued them, going to Delaware court to basically force them to close at the 135 initial deal price. LVMH coming back with a countersuit saying, oh, there's also a material adverse effect. And on the MAE side, one precedent that I forgot to mention, we talked about a lot on this podcast, was Forescout Advent. And that was one that followed a similar playbook. Forescout released a poor quarter throughout COVID. The private equity buyer, Advent, they claimed an MAE. Then on the steps of the courthouse, basically the day before they were set to go to trial, they settled on, I believe, an 8% price cut, then closed the deal. And so throughout this cycle, we actually have not seen a ruling on an MAE. We've seen a number of deals in which the acquirer tried to get out citing an MAE, but thus far, we've seen them either settle at a lower price, as we saw on Forescout Advent, you saw it on an asset deal between Bed Bath & Beyond and 1-800-Flowers, And the other scenario were that the parties agreed to terminate, which we saw on Sycamore and Elbrands with respect to the Victoria's Secret deal. And so will we actually see a precedent on this MAE factor throughout COVID on LVMH, Tiffany? I don't think so, as you indicated. Commentary that 50% chance of a deal reprice, which is the most likely scenario. I've seen estimates as high as a 20% price cut. I think we're gonna see it in the range of the precedents, sort of in that 5 to 12% range. And we looked over the past decade and that we've never seen a price cut more than 12%.
And I think some of the rationale for why it would be a 20% price cut is that why would Arnault go through such trouble and such personal, putting his own brand himself on the line for just a 5 to 10% price cut. So if that is what happens, you got to think that the brand deterioration from just himself, not the company, just himself, that can't really be worth it.
Yeah, but even an 8% price cut puts a few hundred million dollars in his jeans, which, you know, that's a pretty big yacht for him, so I'm sure he'd be happy with it. On to some Tesla news. Now, stock market darling Tesla, I mean, their shares are up, what, 330% year to date? Been an absolute rocket. Last week, and there's been speculation over the past number of weeks of people, you know, trying to front run the S&P 500 on potential index inclusion on a rebalance. Well, the Standard & Poor's Index Committee came out last Friday and said, no, Tesla's not going to be added. And this was a head scratcher for the market because Tesla met all the quantitative measures needed to be added to the S&P 500. And so market participants were shocked, especially Tesla bulls were quite angry and upset that the index committee snubbed the electrical vehicle maker. I mean, you look at their market cap, nearly $350 billion, which makes it one of the largest public companies in the world. It's been absolutely on fire since it IPO'd over a half dozen years ago. It's well over a 10-bagger, and I think it's up fourfold since Elon came out with his whole going private at 420 tweet. Obviously after that, it recently split the stock, and so that got a split adjust that. And instead the S&P 500 chose to snub Tesla, go with three much smaller companies, Etsy, Teradyne, and Catalent, to add into the S&P 500 index. I couldn't even tell you what Catalent does, but you know, it is a head scratcher that Tesla didn't make it. The key metric being 4 quarters of profitability, which last quarter they did prove out. They did get the 4 quarters of profitable earnings, positive earnings. However, you know, that's debatable because on the durability of those earnings, you can say, oh, it was all based on regulatory credits, etc. But in my opinion, this looks real, real bad on the S&P 500. This is supposed to be the largest so-called passive index in the world, but clearly excluding Tesla is a straight-up active investment decision. It met all of their criteria, all the quantitative characteristics that they need. It's a massive, massive market cap of a company, and they just said, no, we're not adding it. So clearly an active decision. What's even worse is they did not give a reason for the exclusion, even though it made all of their requirements to be added. There's some speculation that because Tesla's share price has gone up over threefold this year, there's a view that the skyrocketing share price and the massive market cap isn't based on fundamentals, but it's based on future hype, and that the share price rise was due to retail trader speculation, as we always talk about on these free trading apps. These unsophisticated traders piling in, pushing the stock price up, and you know, these kind of newbie gamblers, they have a different effect and different needs that, you know, traditional, you know, Wall Street conservative index investors would have. What are your thoughts on this real strange move by S&P? And do you think it's safe to classify the S&P 500 as the world's largest actively managed fund?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess our listeners
may recall some of my views on Tesla, where I am the furthest from a Tesla bull, but I think my view may surprise some of them, where, yes, this came, what it seems like is that it came down to earnings quality, specifically, as you had mentioned, the sale of regulatory credits to other automakers, which is about 25% of their EBITDA.
But that's speculative at this point, because we'll never know. S&P did not tell us why specifically they got excluded.
I assume,
as you indicated,
they probably leaked it a little bit to Wall Street Journal, is my assumption there, as that's who came out with the article describing the situation. But, you know, so I don't argue with their earnings quality. I think their earnings quality is very poor.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really matter, because also I'm not really very convinced that the S&P is in a position that they are, that's their skill set, is judging earnings quality. And are they doing that for other constituents?
Exactly. What you mentioned right there, that's called fundamental analysis.
Exactly.
And fundamental analysis is used by active stock pickers, not passive index providers.
And if they're starting to engage in fundamental analysis, then it begs the question of why their index is market cap weighted, why it wouldn't it be valuated, or something of that nature that would bring in more fundamental analysis. So you can see where this doesn't really square with their entire business model, and really just doesn't seem consistent in terms of how they would have treated other companies. And once again, like, I am not a Tesla bull, but really just, when you had mentioned, are they the largest actively managed fund? Now, this is something that you and I have debated countless times in our office, but something like this, I would tend to agree with you. It's a very weird look for a, in quotes, I'm air quoting, a passive index. On the other side, Tesla has been on the NASDAQ composite index for a number of years, so which is more tech heavy. But that's more an example of, okay, they're taking their criteria and they are just basically adding and dropping names in a systematic fashion, which is really what your whole goal of allocating to an S&P index strategy is, that it is systematic, that
rules
they have
based.
Yes, exactly.
And they've had
based
index trickery, I'll call it. This isn't the first time. I remember a number of months ago, I believe it was the Russell indices, in which they didn't rebalance on a certain date because they claimed that it was too volatile, which is ridiculous in my opinion. You have an index that's driven by rules. You must stick with the rules. You must be systematic, irrespective of your fundamental views. Otherwise, that's the definition of active. When you're not systematic, when you're not following any sort of rule sets, you're just sort of flying by the seat of your pants and doing it that way. But, you know, in my opinion, we've had this debate what seems like 1,000 times, is I don't believe there's anything truly passive, because you see this so-called index trickery time and time again, where they're straight up making fundamental calls. I've criticized the Dow Jones index for, you know, selling General Electric, buying Walgreens, and now with the Apple stock split, they've decided to sell that position way down.
Because it's price weighted.
Yeah, exactly. So how do you describe that? That, my friends, is active investing, and, you know, if you want to convince me that that's actually passive, I'm down to argue about it any time of the week. But Mike, anything else on this file?
No, nothing else. I this is where I would agree with you wholeheartedly that this is active management on behalf of S&P. So we can put a cork in that argument for another time, I guess.
Tesla and index front runners. Not happy with this, as the stock dropped a record 21% on the S&P 500 snub. So that's that on Tesla's shares, still up massively this year. That about wraps it up, folks, for episode 86 of the Absolute Return Podcast. If you enjoyed it, please recommend it to your friends, coworkers, fellow investors. You can always check out more at absolutereturnpodcast.com. And I implore you to follow Mike on Twitter. What's your handle?
M_Kessling.
Mine's at Julian Klimochko. And we wish you all the best in your investing, trading, and speculating. And hope you have a great week. Chat with you soon. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.